The Missoula County Attorney wants to sue the Federal Justice Department. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. In our ongoing series on the Bakken, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce looks into the growth of sex trafficking in the region. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with retired smoke jumper Wayne Williams about changes he believes are needed in the training of wildland firefighters. The Missoula County Attorney says he thinks it's time the county go on the offensive in his office's year-and-a-half-long standoff with the United States Department of Justice. DOJ earlier this year reached agreements with the University of Montana and the City of Missoula after investigations revealed deficiencies in how they responded to reports of sexual assault. Those agreements have required UM and the city take several steps to improve their responses. County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg refuses to consent to any such deal. Van Valkenburg today told Commissioners Bill Carey, Michelle Landquist, and Gene Curtis that Montana's U.S. Attorney, Michael Cotter, recently presented him with a proposed draft settlement. He described it as similar to DOJ's agreement with the city of Missoula. Van Valkenburg says the draft also would require his office hire 2 to 3 additional staff for at least 2 years.
I think we would be making somewhere in the neighborhood of a $300,000 to $400,000 financial commitment to do what they are proposing be done in this case. That would be over a 2-year period. It would be $150,000 to $200,000 annually minimum. So, you know, there are very significant financial consequences to agreeing to what they are proposing to do.
Missoula County set aside $50,000 to help fund the costs associated with whatever agreement may be reached with DOJ, assuming one is reached at all. Van Valkenburg today recommended that money instead be used to take the fight to the Justice Department. He said the county could use a chunk of that money in legal fees to try to negotiate an agreement with the feds. He also presented them with another idea, one that he favors.
Pursue a declaratory judgment action in which we take the Department of Justice to court. Essentially argue to the federal judges that they do not have authority to conduct this investigation. They don't have authority to pursue a civil lawsuit, and that even if they did, the doctrine of prosecutorial immunity would essentially close the door on them, regardless of whether they have a statute that gives them authority to pursue this or not.
Van Valkenburg said if he had a spare $10 million to spend as he wished, he'd reject the Justice Department's proposal.
And the reason for that is that this proposal is not based on fact. There's nothing that justifies it. It is not legally necessary, because I do not think that the Department of Justice has the legal authority to do this, and it is a totally unprecedented action on the part of the Department of Justice to seek this kind of a remedy against a local prosecutor's office. They have never before done this to any prosecutor in America.
He said the Missoula County Attorney's Office has and continues to take a careful and detailed look at how it makes its prosecutorial decisions. For instance, if the Missoula Police Department recommends prosecution in a sexual assault case, Van Valkenburg says his office will attempt to make a decision on that request within 2 weeks. Missoula County Commission Chair Gene Curtis says the Justice Department has not presented a clear case.
Fred is a very successful attorney, and he builds a very good case. I think the aggravating thing all along has been that the Department of Justice has never been clear as to what the problem is that they want us to remedy. And yet, through this year and a half, Fred's office has definitely worked with the city and the university to establish some new protocols to help people understand better what different officers are doing and why. So I think that we've done some things to improve the process, but we still don't really know what the Department of Justice thinks the county attorney's office is doing wrong.
And what if the county agrees to seek a declaratory judgment in this matter and eventually loses in federal court? Van Valkenburg says it's worth a shot.
I think if you read what the Department of Justice has said, they, unless you're willing to just agree to what they're proposing, the hornet's nest has already been kicked over by them. I mean, it's going to happen, and it's just a matter of when it happens.
Van Valkenburg says he'll soon formally reject the DOJ's draft agreement. The county commission made no decision today and will await the Justice Department's next move. And in other news from around the state, One snowmobiler died and two others suffered minor injuries in an avalanche in southwestern Montana, marking the fourth death in the region in a week. Gallatin County Sheriff Brian Gutkin says 46-year-old Burton Kenneth Gibson of Bozeman and two 19-year-old men were snowmobiling in Onion Basin, southeast of Big Sky, yesterday afternoon when they were caught in the slide. Gibson was buried. The two other riders were able to locate him using avalanche transceivers, but CPR efforts failed. Searchers plan to return to the area today to recover Gibson's body. Three other people have died in avalanches in Wyoming and Colorado over the past week. Skier Mike Kazanji of Santa Ana, California, and snowmobiler Rex Anderson of Arco, Idaho, died in separate avalanches near Jackson, Wyoming, the day after Christmas. Another person died Tuesday in a slide north of Granby, Colorado. Former Republican Congressman Denny Rehberg says he's considering running to get his old seat in the House back. Rehberg gave up the seat to run an unsuccessful campaign for the U.S. Senate against John Tester. In an interview on the radio show Voices of Montana, Rehberg said he's getting lots of encouragement to run again for the House and is seriously considering it. Following a string of explosive accidents, federal officials say crude oil being shipped by rail from the northern plains across the U.S. and Canada may be more flammable than traditional forms of oil. The U.S. Department of Transportation issued a safety alert today. It warns the public, emergency responders, and shippers about the potential high volatility of crude being shipped from the Bakken oil shale patch in Montana and North Dakota. The warning comes in the aftermath of the massive explosion caused by Monday's oil train derailment near Castleton, North Dakota. No one was hurt, but worries about toxic fumes prompted the evacuation of hundreds of residents. In July, a Bakken crude train derailment killed 47 people in Quebec. Another oil train derailed and exploded in Alabama in November. Train derailments aren't the only side effects of the Bakken oil boom. Tonight, we continue our series on those side effects. The nature of an oil boom brings the conditions necessary for the growth of illegal industries. Tonight, we're talking about prostitution. The workforce of the Bakken is well paid and is predominantly male. Ask people who live there, and it won't take long before you start hearing rumors about a rise in prostitution. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says law enforcement is trying to find ways to verify those claims.
We clean oil-filled offices.
Tiffany Aho runs a cleaning company in Sydney, Montana.
Occasionally man camps as well.
She says she never sends just one of her female employees out to a cleaning job. She sends them in pairs. That does not stop the propositions from coming.
We get several people when we're out on locations that ask if we offer more services than just cleaning.
This is the kind of anecdotal story you hear about prostitution in the Bakken.
These scantily clad women walking in, and they will hop tables until they find a John to take them home. I've heard about it at Applebee's. I've heard about it at any bar you can name.
A Friday night at J-Dub's Bar and Grill in Williston, North Dakota begins and ends with flashing multicolored lights, thumping dance music, and crowds of young men with money to spend. 24-year-old Williston native Nathan Clyer came here with some friends for a few drinks.
A lot of testosterone being thrown around in this town.
He dropped out of college after discovering he could make more money than both his parents working in the oil industry. Clyer says so many high-paying jobs and an overabundance of men has led to a rise in prostitution in his hometown.
If you're looking for it, you can find it. It's there. There's women looking to make money too.
Scan the North Dakota section of the online classified site Backpage.com and you can find a steady stream, pages of postings from female escorts, revealing pictures of women offering companionship, massages, and more. Oftentimes, the escorts say they will only be around for a couple days, and many posts contain disclaimers saying anything that happens is between two consenting adults. Brian Lockerbie is the administrator of the Department of Criminal Investigation in the Montana Department of Justice.
I mean, you can't put your finger on it. It's just a rumor.
He says law enforcement is having a really hard time grasping the scope of prostitution in the region, even with all the indicators. He says the problem is officers don't have the training or resources to effectively approach the issue.
The hardest part is realizing treating the prostitute as a victim.
He says traditionally in a prostitution bust, both the prostitute and the client are arrested and charged with misdemeanor offenses. It makes the prostitutes understandably leery of law enforcement, even though he says most were brought into the trade through illegal trafficking by pimps.
About 70% of the women that have gotten into prostitution started at the age of 13 to 14 when they were recruited by pimps and eventually turned into prostitutes.
Lockerbie says prostitutes can still be charged with breaking the law if caught. But the state is trying to give these women more options, offering them deferred or suspended sentences if they provide information leading to the capture of pimps. Specific training in recognizing sex trafficking has been offered at the State Law Enforcement Academy for the last couple of years. Montana also established a human trafficking task force in 2012, a partnership among the state and federal agencies such as the FBI, IRS, and Homeland Security. Lockerbie says that interagency cooperation helps in trying to address the issue in the multi-state Bakken region. Still, the task force has only prosecuted about 2 cases of sex trafficking per year since forming. Lockerbie hopes growing public awareness will lead to more arrests. Until it does, the Bakken oil field will continue to provide economic opportunity not only for the masses, but for organized crime as well.
Guns, drugs, prostitution, all of that goes hand in hand.
I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
You can see all the pieces aired so far in our series, Bakken Spinoffs, on our website, mtpr.org. Wayne Williams started fighting wildfires in 1974 and became a smoke jumper in 1977. Over his 40-year career, the now-retired Missoula smoke jumper was mentored by and himself mentored many other wildland firefighters. Williams was part of the team that recovered the bodies of 14 firefighters who died fighting the South Canyon Fire on Storm King Mountain in Colorado in 1994. That incident prompted several changes in firefighting safety protocols and strategy. This past summer's tragic deaths of 19 hotshots in the Yarnell Hill Fire in Arizona, almost an entire crew, again shocked the firefighting community and has many, including Williams, reevaluating this country's firefighting training and methods. In this feature interview, Williams talks with News Director Sally Mock about what he thinks needs to change. Williams says he first learned of the Yarnell Hill tragedy when he got a text from a friend.
My very first thought was to the families, because I remember the unimaginable sorrow and pain that the families felt at South Canyon. It was just miserable. And that was the very first thing that went through my mind. I think back to when I called my mother after the morning after South Canyon and just let her know I was okay. And she said something to me that I'll never forget. And she says, I knew you were all right, but all I can do is just think about those mothers. That's all I can do.
Of course, everyone was shocked at what happened at Yarnell, and a lot of questions since. And there was initially an investigation that I think everyone unanimously agreed answered nothing about what had happened and was seen as not a very good report. Do you think that's fair to say?
Well, not quite. There's a new way of looking at how to learn from these types of tragedies. And if you just strictly go after people and blame, then the opportunity to learn something from an incident like this is lost. So I think the first investigation group really wanted to put out, they wanted to give people an opportunity to read about what had happened and then possibly learn from those events, and then possibly have some formal opportunities for training later on down the road based off of that tragedy.
Well, then the second report came out, and this was by the Arizona Division of Occupational Safety and Health, and they did blame people. They blamed the State Forestry Division for, quote, putting protection of homes over firefighter safety.
And I read both reports, and I did see that. And I think that wildland firefighting has taken an unfortunate turn as far as structure protection. I think that in a sense we've become better at protecting structures than actually fighting the fire. And let me clarify that a little bit. So when I first started fighting fire in 1974, and I remember my very first experience down in Southern California, the whole emphasis was stop the fire first, because that's always going to be our greatest risk. We can always replace a home, but we have to stop the fire first. And as soon as we stop the fire, less homes are in danger. And that is a geographic area that has had to deal with structure protection for a long, long time. There's been a change to where it's more about protecting the structures and just kind of letting the fire keep going.
Is that because when the fire is going to keep going, that fire conditions have become so different and so much more dire? Like, we don't have 100-acre fires as much as we have 100,000-acre fires now, and they get a momentum that makes it impossible to actually, quote, fight them. That's one theory.
Right, and I've heard that. And I do think that climate conditions have certainly made fires harder to control. But I also think that strategies for fighting fires are not based on putting the fire out so much as protecting the structures.
And there are so many more structures out there.
Right. So I also think that a lot of wildland firefighters have become better at protecting structures than actually fighting fire, because that seems to be something that we do more of now. Personally, not much different than a hurricane or an earthquake or anything else, you're far better off to build something to withstand that kind of event than you are trying to protect it. I live in the urban interface myself. The last thing I would want is for a firefighter or a crew of firefighters to die defending my house.
You know, every homeowner I've talked to during a fire season says that. But also, they turn around and say, where are the firefighters? I want them here now protecting my home.
If they had built their house in a way that it would be to have a better chance of surviving a fire, and then also landscaped, then I think they wouldn't be worrying about where the firefighters were, because they would know that their house would make it.
Mm-hmm.
And this day and age, I think that it may be expensive, but it's real doable. Maybe 20 years ago, no, but certainly when you look at things like hurricanes as an example, there's certain building codes that those people have to abide by, certain insurance issues they have to deal with because of where they chose to live. It seems in wildland, it seems the urban interface doesn't seem to have to cop up to that.
Yet. We've talked, Wayne, too, that when you started out as a firefighter in 1974, the culture there was much different than it is now. You had many, many mentors who brought you along to become an expert smoke jumper and firefighter. And you feel like that has changed as well.
It has changed because right around 1990, 91, somewhere in there, I was doing some work in the Washington office for the Forest Service. And there were people back then that were saying, you know, we're going to have this huge experience deficit because we're going to have people who are going to be retiring at the mandatory retirement age of 50. So we have hard numbers. We know that we're going to lose these people on an exact date. And we need to start taking care of that. We need to start working with this issue. And for the most part, it was ignored. And so what that meant was when we finally decided we were going to do something about it, it was 2001, we lost a lot of that experience from retirement. And at the same time, we diluted our experience by expanding crews, which is a bad combination. And that is the elephant in the room that I think a lot of people are ignoring. Take my career. When I started, there were very few people who were beginning. There was a huge middle class of experienced people. And then there was a very small group that were getting ready to retire. So as I went through my mentoring, I would slowly move from being a new guy into that the very beginning of that experience base, and I'd be getting several mentors. And at the same time, I'm aging. And then eventually by time, you know, I had 10, 15 years experience and several mentors and people who had looked at my specific skills and said, this is what you'd be good at. And this is what we're going to educate you in as far as firefighting. And so when I finally popped out on the other end, two things that happened. I'd gained a lot of experience. I'd had a lot of mentors. And I had aged. And I think those are important things.
Nothing beats experience, obviously. Wayne, what do you think about all the discussion of the culture of firefighting in terms of it being a macho culture? I mean, we call crews hotshots, and that elevates them above other firefighters, for example. Does that play into decisions maybe that shouldn't be made sometimes because you're trying to live up to this label that you're a hotshot and you won't back down?
Well, staying with that experience issue that we were just talking about, I have a couple of friends who were hotshot superintendents, and they say, you know, every year they have a different makeup of their crew, and so they have to adjust what they can do on the fire line with what that experience base is. So I would say that they are being realistic about the hand they're dealt, and that they're looking at, okay, last year I had a really experienced squad leader, but this year I don't. So I'm going to have to keep an eye on that guy. If I have a specific fire that's worrisome to me, then I need to know what my crew can do. And then I also need to know what I should do if we're getting in over our head. I need to be honest about that. And so I think there are ways, you know, that you can manage that inexperience.
There are many things that people discuss now about what needs to change to make sure we don't ever have another Storm King or Yarnell Hill tragedy. And it's not all going to change overnight, that's for sure. But if you could change one thing right now, that would make a huge difference. Can you pinpoint what that might be?
That's a tough question, but I would say that I'm sort of wishing that people would realize that there's a lot of inexperience out there, real solid inexperience. And what I mean by that is experience isn't just simply being someplace for 20 years. Experience is what I refer to as geographic experience. It means that you've traveled throughout the United States fighting fire in the tundras of Alaska, the brush of Southern California, the pine trees of Mississippi. You've been around. And I think that our system that's in place right now that actually sort of came out of South Canyon, which is a qualification system that's based off of a task book. I would change that because I don't initially the task book was this way that we could prevent people who maybe didn't have the right stuff to be in a specific qualification on the fire line. But what it's done instead is that it's just simply delayed people who might be really good at that qualification and people who probably aren't that good. It hasn't prevented that from happening. So I think we have to take a hard look at our qualification system. Is it really working? I don't really think it is.
Well, I was speaking with Wayne Williams, who has been fighting fire for 40 years, a former smoke jumper, and has some thoughts about the tragedy of this summer and the tragedy of 1994 that he was very personally involved in. Wayne, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is a winter storm warning currently in effect until 5 a.m. Saturday for the West Glacier region. Tonight, rain with snow is likely, with lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, look for cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind watch currently in effect until tomorrow afternoon for the Rocky Mountain Front. Eastern Glacier County, Hill, Cascade, Shoto, central and southern Lewis and Clark County, Toole, Liberty, Eastern Ponderay, Blaine, Eastern Teton, Judith Basin, and Fergus counties. There's also a winter storm warning in effect currently until 11 a.m. Saturday for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow through the night with lows in the 30s. Wind gusts could reach up to 50 miles per hour. Tomorrow, snow is likely through the day with a chance of rain and highs in the 30s. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. And in southwest Montana, there's a high wind watch in effect currently until, and it's in effect through tomorrow afternoon for Jefferson and Broadwater counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 20 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the day, highs in the 30s. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. And now for the editorial comments of Annie Heiser.
Living in Montana, we like to think of ourselves as living in farm country. Big trucks, rolling hay fields, thriving farmers markets, and delicious grass-fed beef. We've got it all. But for generations, farm families across the country and across our region have been sending their children away from the farm, oftentimes for good reasons. Land prices have skyrocketed. The global ag economy has experienced massive vertical and horizontal integration, meaning that the largest corporations are gaining an ever bigger piece of the pie, while the margins on the farm get narrower and narrower. If you're trying to compete with grain growers in the Midwest and cattle ranchers in California, it's a tough time to be a farmer. Those changes have meant that we now have 28 million fewer farmers than we had in 1920, while America has 200 million more people to feed. While it's tough to be a farmer, this is a trend that we can't afford to just hope will improve itself. But luckily, the story doesn't end there. Thousands of young people across the country are bucking the trend by starting farms of their own. They represent an incredible opportunity for America. And many are farming differently. They're raising their livestock on grass instead of corn, and growing crops with an eye towards heritage, taste, and beauty instead of towards shelf life. They're building community and building an economy with new jobs and new income streams in areas that haven't seen new industry in a long time. Liz Uhas is an example of one of those farmers. Liz runs Better Root Gardens, a small farm in Target Range, raising food for a community-supported agriculture, or CSA, program. In a CSA, a citizen pays a lump sum up front and receives weekly vegetable deliveries throughout the growing season. But it's more than a purely transactional experience. By paying the farmer a lump sum payment in the early season, when the farmer needs funding the most to pay for seeds and other costs, the farmer and the citizen are bound together. As Liz says, being a part of a CSA brings one closer to one's food and community. Hailing from Missoula originally, Liz recently returned and started her farm while working as a teacher. She farms to add income and to take advantage of her off time in the summer. But beyond that, Liz loves to farm. She loves the physical, outdoor work and the fact that it's never the same. She's always learning, always solving new problems. Plus, she loves the community it brings her. Right now, Liz's CSA program serves 4 families, but she hopes to expand it to 20 families in the next few years. But Liz wasn't raised on a farm, and she didn't go to school for agriculture. So in getting started, like many of the thousands of other young farmers across the country, Liz needs a little help. That's why the Community, Food, and Agriculture Coalition, the Alternative Energy Resources Organization, and many other partners are coming together from across the state this winter to offer classes and workshops that will help farmers build more successful, sustainable businesses. There's the workshop series called Planning for On-Farm Success, which will help beginning farmers like Liz get their footing, figuring out their goals and how to reach them, creating marketing plans, finding funding, and assessing and managing their risks. Another workshop series focuses on multifunctional farming, which helps more established farmers find new enterprises they can start to add value to their operations. Examples include adding a farm stand, a bed and breakfast, or a children's daycare. Both workshop series aim to inspire farmers, share expertise, and help bring great ideas to life. For more information on the courses, visit www.missoulacfac.org. Liz is taking the series on planning for on-farm success. She realizes that she needs a plan in order to move forward and wants a more formalized introduction to learning about marketing, financing opportunities, and risk assessment. For example, the Farm Service Agency runs a loan program to help beginning farmers buy land. But how does it work? As her business grows, Liz may need to hire employees. What does she need to know to grow her business? The Food and Drug Administration is in the process of reworking the nation's food safety regulations. What rules are farmers like Liz supposed to follow? How can she keep our food safe? I'm dealing with people's food, Liz says, and I want to approach this business with my eyes wide open. That's just what the workshops aim to provide. And it's our hope that in helping our community's farmers, we'll make a better, more sustainable community for ourselves as well. In Missoula, I'm Annie Heiser for the Alternative Energy Resources Organization. Arrow has been linking people with sustainable agriculture and energy solutions since 1974. Visit us online at arrowmt.org.
Annie Heiser is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.